America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings. Oh, my. I want to just call out to, or say hi to, call out, shout out, whatever, to TPM, Talking Points Memo, and just Josh Marshall and company. Pointing out what's going on with Mr. Segelman's prosecution. This is fascinating, out of Montgomery, Alabama, and this is a story that is the Karl Rove story, in my opinion. I mean, we'll see. Time will tell. We'll see how this all plays out. But this sure seems to me like this is the Karl Rove story, and the reason why it's the Karl Rove story is that there's a lot of concern that Don Segelman, well, actually, I think it goes back to 2002. So let me just give you the background on this thing. First of all, here's what's going on right now. What's going on right now, Don Segelman is the former governor of Alabama. He's a Democrat. In the 2002 election, this is back when Rove and Bush were riding high and everything was fine. 2002, you know, vote caging, strange machines, odd stuff going on, and nobody was looking, nobody was talking about it. I think the only guy who was even writing about this stuff was me. I was, you know, back then I wrote several articles about what was going on with voting machines, what was going on with Chuck Hagel. Did a piece that MoveOn.org commissioned that they mailed out to what was then a 1.6 million person mailing list, and it really wasn't much on the radar screen. Vote fraud or election fraud, I guess, is technically what it should be called, because we're not talking about vote fraud. And in the election of 2002, now I remember when this happened, and I remember thinking, boy, this is strange. Don Segelman was running against Bob Riley. He was a Republican member of Congress. And there was also a libertarian in the game, John Sophocles. And when the polls closed, you know, when everything was all said and done, Bob Riley was behind, and Don Segelman, the incumbent, was ahead. He won the election, it looked like. And just, you know, to share with you, this is just the Wikipedia entry. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. Los Angeles Times has done some pieces on this. There have been a number of articles about it, but it really hasn't gotten much national play. But this is back to 2002, first of all. So the result was nearly a dead tie between Segelman and Riley. Riley's victory was controversial and caused many commentators to recall a Florida election recount of 2000. Initial returns showed Riley narrowly losing to Segelman. However, Republican officials in Baldwin County, one of the few counties where all of the county officers in charge of elections were Republicans, decided to conduct a recount after midnight in their own county after the Democratic poll observers had gone home. And lo and behold, when these guys did their own recount in their own county, after the Democrats had gone home, they discovered that there were 6,000 votes that Segelman had. Now, this is a guy who had lost, or who had won, rather, by fewer than 1,000 votes. I mean, this was a squeaker. And they found that there were 6,000 votes that shouldn't have been given to him. They should have been given to Riley. And so they basically moved these 6,000 votes over to Riley. They blamed it on a, quote, computer glitch. Honest to God, the local Republican officials who did their own recount in the dead of night, I mean, literally after midnight, in Baldwin County, Alabama, they said, well, we've got a computer glitch here. There's 6,000 votes that should have gone to Bob Riley, and they went to Siegelman instead. Exactly 6,000. Nice round number. And what that did was it threw the election to Riley. So Siegelman goes out, and he starts saying, you know, I've been ripped off. You know, the Republicans, they're up to some kind of dirty trick here. And Alabama's a state where there's a lot of right-wing talk radio, local right-wing talk radio. And they just started trashing him. Oh, he's a whiner, he's a complainer, and the local media is mostly conservative, and the local media didn't much take it seriously, and it wasn't, you know, even really well pointed out that, you know, this was after midnight, after the Democratic poll watchers had gone home. You know, just the absurdity, the obscenity of this. And finally, Siegelman just said, okay, that's it. I'm not going to fight this. He initially was going to fight it. He was going to ask for a real recount. And this was the, you know, this 3,000 vote margin now. I said fewer than 1,000. It was fewer than 3,000 votes, about a 3,000 vote margin. And that 6,000 vote discovery that the Republicans made in their own county, in the county that they entirely controlled on their voting machines, flipped that election and gave that election to the Republican, to Bob Riley. So Don Siegelman is, you know, hanging around. This guy is a substantial politician. He was the governor of Alabama from 1999 to 2003. He's the only guy who had ever served as both the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the Lieutenant Governor, and the Governor. 26 years in Alabama politics. He won his first election for the governorship with 57% of the vote, including over 90% of the African-American electorate, which is a substantial voting bloc in Alabama. So the Bush administration comes into office. He loses the 2002 election. He starts making waves. And a new prosecutor, a new U.S. attorney is put in by Roe v. Bush. And this new U.S. attorney decides to go after Siegelman. And they prosecute him. And big time. I mean, they went after him and they nailed him. And he got this huge sentence. And there's a lot of folks who are thinking, you know, what is, come on, this is over the top. And in fact, part of his defense now is that he was singled out because he was a Democrat by the U.S. attorneys, by the Republican U.S. attorneys as part of Karl Rove's, you know, political operation. That he was singled out because he was a Democrat, and he was nailed because he was a Democrat, and that's just plain old flat-out wrong. It shouldn't have happened. And you know, this could be the smoking gun in the U.S. attorney scandal. I mean, there's a major piece of this that has to do with the U.S. attorney scandal. And so now, and here's where the news, you know, to bring it up to the moment. And well, actually, before I bring it up to the moment, let me just back up a little bit. Back to July. Here we are. It's the end of August. This is just a month and a half ago, 6 weeks ago. Again, to point out how important this could be to the White House. This, as I'm saying, this could be the thing that conceivably could lead to criminal charges being filed against Bush, against Gonzalez, against the whole bunch of them. July 17th, Los Angeles Times, 44 state attorneys general have sent a petition to Congress asking legislators to investigate the Justice Department's prosecution of former Governor Don Siegelman on corruption charges. 44 state attorneys general, the chief law enforcement officers in 44 former states attorneys general, 44 of them. They write, we urge the Congress to take immediate action to investigate this entire matter so that the public may be assured that the outcome is just. Siegelman was convicted last year of bribery and obstruction of justice. He was taken in shackles from his sentencing hearing last month to begin immediately serving a 7-year prison sentence. There are a number of prominent Republicans, including former Attorney General, Arizona Attorney General Grant Woods and former Kansas Attorney General Robert Steffen. These guys are Republicans saying, let's look into this. And now the Justice Department is claiming that, Siegelman is obstructing justice from his jail cell. His lawyer's totally baffled. He's like, this guy's in lockdown. This guy has, the only person he can even talk to on the phone is his wife, and he's obstructing justice from his jail cell? What's going on here? Is the Bush administration about to become unraveled? Is this a last throw? We'll see.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
When your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong, move along like I know you do.
Okay, now I've given you the broad brush. Here's where it gets really and truly bizarre. This is where it gets really and truly bizarre. And I think everybody in America should be talking about this. This is incredible. These 44 former state attorney generals have petitioned Congress to investigate Siegelman's case. They have the House panel looking into this, the House Judiciary Committee, this is John Conyers committee, has taken sworn testimony from a woman by the name of Dana Jill Simpson, a Republican lawyer who assisted the successful 2002 campaign of Siegelman's opponent, Bob Riley, the guy, the governor now. Bob Riley, the former Republican congressman. Dana Jill Simpson, in a sworn statement, said that during a conference call, and I'm reading from the Los Angeles Times article by Tom Hamburger. In her statement, she said that during a conference call with other GOP campaign aides, she heard Riley strategist, this is the Republican running for governor, she heard Riley strategist Bill Canary, now remember that name, Bill Canary, tell other campaign workers not to worry about Siegelman because, quote, his girls, end quotes, meaning two U.S. attorneys in Alabama, one of whom was his wife, would, quote, would take care of Siegelman, end quote. Sampson's affidavit. Now, keep in mind, this is not Siegelman saying this. This is a Republican lawyer who worked on the successful campaign of the Republican who won the gubernatorial race only after in that one county controlled by Republicans, after the Democrats had gone home at midnight, they did a recount and they said, oh, gee, look at this. There's a computer glitch. Suddenly 6,000 votes moved from Siegelman to Riley and they declared Riley the winner. Okay. This is a Republican lawyer working on that campaign. And she says that Riley's, the Republicans' campaign strategist, Bill Canary, is going to use his wife to take out Siegelman. She said she heard Canary say that Carl had assured him that the Justice Department was going to pursue a case against the former governor. Canary, by the way, has worked on campaigns with Rove in the past, notes in the Los Angeles Times. Now, his wife, Laura, keep in mind, Canary, Bill Canary, the Republican campaign strategist down in Alabama, married to the U.S. attorney, Republican U.S. attorney down in Alabama, it's not partisan, but a Bush appointee. His wife, Laura, is the U.S. attorney whose office brought the case against Siegelman. So here you have a guy who, in a sworn statement, another Republican lawyer working with him, Dana Jill Simpson, has said, you know, out loud, right up front, has said that she overheard him talking about how his girls, his wife and another U.S. attorney in Alabama, these two appointees, two U.S. attorneys, were going to take down Siegelman. Don't worry. We're going to win this campaign, and after we win this campaign, if this guy makes some noise, we're going to take him down. And sure enough, he did make some noise. And so now, here is the story from today that brings this whole thing full circle and why this should be big news for today. Former Governor Don, this is from the Associated Press, Jay Reeves writing, former Governor Don Siegelman and ex-Health South CEO Richard Scrushy are, quote, reaching out from their jail cells, end quote, in an attempt to sway events linked into their case in a way that could be obstruction of justice, a federal prosecutor told a judge Wednesday. Speaking during a hearing for former Siegelman aide Nick Bailey, Assistant U.S. Attorney Steve Faga, F-E-A-G-A, said Siegelman and Scrushy had been doing things from behind bars to, quote, manipulate events, end quotes, acts that could be considered a crime. Now, what are they trying to do? They're trying to point out that this thing was a Karl Rove setup from get-go. Scrushy, again from the AP story, Scrushy's attorney, Art Leach, says he was baffled by Faga's comments and denied that Scrushy had done anything wrong in prison. What could he possibly be doing? He's sitting in jail all his time, 600 miles from home. He only gets 300 minutes a month on the phone, and he spends all that with his wife. There needs to be a serious investigation of the vote theft in the 2002 election in Alabama, Bob Riley's governorship, and then Karl Rove's association with it, and then in particular, this guy Canary, whose wife is the U.S. attorney. See, this is the question everybody's been saying all along: don't look at the U.S. attorneys who got fired. That's not the big deal, and unfortunately, that's where the Democrats are putting all their attention. Look at the U.S. attorneys who didn't get fired, and start with Laura Canary, the U.S. attorney who brought this case against the Democrat in Alabama, who won the election until the Republicans went into private session after midnight and said, oh, gee, look at this. We just discovered a voting error, a little glitch here in Baldwin County on the machines, and there's 6,000 votes that were supposed to go to the Republican, and instead they went to the Democrat, so we're going to give them back to the Republican and flip the race. And they did. I mean, this is like, I mean, how much more smoking gun do you need? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Nazis in the bathroom, just below the stairs.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, our blog. Drop into our live chat room over there, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And things are just getting crazier and crazier out there. NBC even, maybe.
Crazy.
That's from, as we say, with these special reports from the Newswire, NBC launches To Catch a Senator, Chris Hansen to stake out airport bathrooms. Dateline, the NBC News magazine, which has scored big ratings for its To Catch a Predator investigations, announced today that it would introduce a new investigative series this fall entitled To Catch a Senator. At a press conference in New York, NBC News President Steve Capus said that To Catch a Senator would focus on Dateline's investigative team's it would focus the Dateline investigation team's energies on the number one menace in America today, pervy Republican senators. While he indicated that plans for the program were still being developed, Mr. Capus said that To Catch a Senator would use an airport bathroom as a nerve center for its sting operation. Specifically, he said that the program would deploy predator host Chris Hansen as a decoy to lure depraved senators into lewd contact. And Mr. Capus said, Chris will be waiting in one of the bathroom stalls, and when the senator taps on the wall, Chris will kind of pop out of the stall and start grilling him. We'll nail that SOB faster than he can say, I'm not gay. But even as NBC trumpeted its latest Dateline spinoff, industry insiders wondered whether there would be an inadequate supply of sex-crazed senators to keep the program going for more than a few episodes. For his part, however, Mr. Capus brushed off such concerns, telling reporters, as long as there are Republican senators out there who oppose gay marriage, there will always be plenty of pervs. Yeah. That's actually from, of course, Andy Borowitz, the BorowitzReport.com, BorowitzReport.com, and with permission. Just as an FYI, if you want more information about the Don Siegelman situation, he's got a website, donsiegelman.org, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N. And right at the top, you'll see the pictures of Jack Abramoff, Karl Rove, George W. Bush, and some of the prosecutors involved in this thing, the whole thing. It's all right there. Don Siegelman, SIEGELMAN.org. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Lucian in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lucian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I was just listening to the Siegelman case that you described, and it sounds like the Republicans have simply acted on hate. Like they just...
No, they're trying to cover up their own crimes. I mean, they stole an election in 2002, and Siegelman would not stop talking about it. And so they, and it may well be that he's a, you know, that he's a corrupt politician. I mean, there's no shortage of corrupt politicians,
yeah,
particularly down in Alabama, particularly somebody who's been in politics for 27 years. But he wouldn't stop talking about the fact that the election was stolen from him. And so the wife of the campaign manager of the guy, of Bob Riley, who ran against him, who lost to him until the Republicans, after midnight, after the Democrats had left, discovered 6,000 votes on a voting machine that just magically appeared. The wife of this guy, as a U.S. attorney, initiates a prosecution against him.
Yeah,
I mean, how weird does this get?
I see the amazing conflicts of interest. But it's just like this sense of us versus them hatred. Instead
yeah.
of, you know, trying to engage the political system the way it was designed, right, as a forum for people to
yeah.
espouse ideas and put forward, you know, ways in which society could move forward.
And no, I get your point, Lucian, but see, I what I'm saying is I don't think that this is so much, you know, Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez and the U.S. Attorney's offices and Bob Riley and whatnot. I don't think this is so much them going after Siegelman because they hate him. I think that they're going after him because for two reasons. Number one, to shut him up, which they've done. I mean, this guy was not even allowed to appeal. He was let after he was convicted. And by the way, there were questions about jury tampering. I mean, the jurors were like emailing each other during this thing and were receiving emails. And that has not been looked into. And initially he had like some 37 charges or something brought against him, and all but two were thrown out with prejudice, which means that the judge says, are you guys kidding me? I mean, they tried to throw the absolute screaming book at this guy, and they ended up convicting him on two things, and one of them was essentially an obstruction of justice, which is, you know, can be, you know, here I am sounding like one of Scooter Libby's apologists, and again, as I say, you know, Siegelman probably is guilty of what he was charged with, but maybe not. But the point is that what they did was they went after him in a way to say to any other Democrat who raises the issue of election fraud, in my opinion. Any Democrat who raises the issue of election fraud, the same way that they went after Joe Wilson's wife, to say,
yeah,
anybody who raises the issue of George Bush lying, we're going to destroy you, we're going to destroy your family. In the case of Don Siegelman, where they came after him and they said they're going to destroy him, they're going to destroy his family, they're going to destroy his life, they didn't just destroy this guy. I mean, he got a 7-year sentence for this. He's in lockdown. The only person he can talk to on the phone is his wife. And now that he's trying to mount a defense against himself, they're charging him with conspiracy to obstruct justice. The justice, apparently, that he's trying to obstruct is that he's trying to launch a defense. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. Lucian, thanks for the call. Timothy in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Timothy.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
The situation in Alabama with the election, you described as terrible, but you also mentioned that this guy Siegelman chose not to fight back initially. And in Ohio in 2004, Kerry.
Well, actually, he did try to fight back initially, and for several days, Siegelman was out there making as much noise as he could for anybody who would hear.
Mm-hmm.
And this absolute chorus of primarily right-wing talk radio hosts, local talk radio hosts all across the state of Alabama and in neighboring states, went on this absolute rampage about how he was a whiner and a complainer and a sore loser and get over it. And at that point, you know, and Riley was, you know, everybody was taking office. And at that point, of course, you had a hostile White House that was, and the Department of Justice was refusing to look into it. And so at that point, I mean, you know, he just, mm-hmm. he had no choice but to back away.
And a related issue, today, Tova Wang, had an article in the Post on election fraud. It was a report that, looked at election fraud all across the country. It was a bipartisan report. When the White House got their hands on it, though, it was scrubbed of anything indicating Republican shenanigans, and then it fraudulently claimed all sorts of Democratic, you know, voter fraud. And
right.
her defense, she said she didn't go public with this information because there was a clause in her contract. So in each of these cases, the Democrats have chose not to fight. In her case, Tova Wang's case, she chose not to go out because of a clause in a contract. Back during the voting rights era, though, people faced dogs, fire hoses, even death to fight for their rights. And now we have this whole new crop of Democratic, quote-unquote, leaders who are intimidated by, you know, contract clauses, and I don't know what. It just seems like they are the party of Neville Chamberlain, not because they're unwilling to fight, you know, terrorists, but they're unwilling to fight an even greater threat to that which America makes America unique, our Constitution. They're unwilling to fight Republicans.
Let's keep in mind that when we say Democrats, that what we really mean is some Democrats. The fact of the matter is John Edwards in 2004 really, really, really wanted to contest Ohio and was very outspoken about it. John Kerry said no. He was at the top of the ticket. Al Gore fought that thing all the way to the Supreme Court. He fought that as far as he could go. They had organized demonstrations 24-7 outside Al Gore's home in Washington, D.C., terrifying his children, shouting, people with bullhorns shouting, get out of Dick Cheney's house. This is when the recount was going on down in Florida.
To bring it back to Siegelman, did he get any support from the DNC or from the national organization?
When the thing happened, when this first happened in 2002, I noticed it. I read the news stories. I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I really didn't, you know, dig into it. And I've only been paying attention to it for the last year or two.
You know, follows your show closely and enjoys it immensely, and is often outraged by what I hear on it. It's often disheartening to, I get the feeling at times that our leadership, the party leadership, is not nearly as aggressive or as ruthless, let's say, as the Republicans.
Well, at this moment, the Senate Judiciary Committee is investigating current and former firings of U.S. attorneys, and as I said, I think that they should be investigating U.S. attorneys who didn't get fired. The House Judiciary Committee has approved contempt citations against Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton over this issue, and they're coming back. The House Intelligence Committee is investigating the administration's secret, warrantless, illegal wiretapping program. The House Oversight and Government Committee is looking into ways that the Bush administration has been using classified as a way of hiding their own political secrets. A lot of this coming out of the plane incident and the use of emails for official business that is illegal.
Wow.
The Democrats are looking into this stuff. There's a number of them out there who are taking names and kicking butt. It's just that.
But at the end of the day,
there's
though,
a few who aren't.
But like in Vietnam, it might be irrelevant too. You know, there was that Vietnamese general who said, "Yeah, you won every battle, but that's irrelevant." In this case.
Yeah.
They may take all those actions, but ultimately I think what the Bush administration finally realized is that in the absence of any sort of, you know, entering the building and taking them out in handcuffs, nothing is going to happen. They realize their entire system is built on trust, mutual respect, and honorable people following the law. They're not willing to do it.
You're right, and that's how and why, and well said, Timothy, thank you, and that's how and why they have so badly corrupted this system. And it's why, frankly, I think that they should be impeached. And it's also, you know, pretty clear in my mind that that's not what's going to happen. But, you know, so what do we do? Well, I think that we need to reveal their crimes and start burrowing into these things. And I think, for example, the Siegelman case is a great place to start. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Good old Donovan. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And a little strange news in the horizon. Yes, this is very strange. Mobile phones. This is from the Daily Mail, the newspaper in the United Kingdom. Mobile phones can take as little as 10 minutes to trigger changes in the brain associated with cancer, scientists claimed yesterday. They found even low levels of radiation from handsets interfere with the way brain cells divide. Cellular division encourages the growth of tumors. There's a new study that's done by the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, and it suggests that non-thermal radiation could pose a risk. In other words, this isn't just like, you know, heating up the side of your head. It's the actual frequency, 875 megahertz, a frequency that is used or similar to one used by mobile phones. They exposed both human and rat cells in a laboratory. And they said although the radiation was far weaker than the emissions from a typical handset, and this is even less strong than a headphone, it began to switch on the chemical signal inside the cell within 10 minutes. The chemical signals they detected were involved in the division of cells. Division of cells, of course, involved in cancer. It's interesting. Last night we went to see the 11th hour premiere, or the opening, not the premiere, the sneak peek here in Portland. I guess it's opening next week or this weekend. And afterwards, went to dinner with a couple of our kids and some friends, and one of them, Nora Gagatis, who's runs Northwest Neurofeedback. She's a neurofeedback therapist here in Portland. And Nora was telling us how over the last 10 years or so, I mean, she's looking at people's brains, and she does this for a living and has been doing it for, you know, well over a decade, and helps them train their brains to be more functional. I mean, you know, from people with serious and severe neurological disorders and deficits to things like, you know, ADD, or people just want to learn how to focus and concentrate better. And she said that what she's finding is that it used to be, you know, 10 years ago, there was kind of this balance between hyper-arousal and hypo-arousal, people whose brains needed to be stimulated versus people whose brains needed to be calmed down. And she said now it's just everybody's brain needs to be calmed down over more and more and more. And it's even hard to get the equipment to go to as low a frequency as is necessary to make it happen. It was just, and then today this, and we were talking about, you know, why would that be? And she said, well, I don't know. There's all these cell phone towers around that weren't around 10 years ago. I wonder if that has something to do with it. And it's odd. Anyhow, Elizabeth in Seattle, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Elizabeth, what's up?
Oh, yeah. It was just a brief comment. You know, we're all wondering why Kerry did not challenge the election. And you may be very right about backroom threats. But I watched the video Stealing America, Vote by Vote, mm-hmm. the other night. And there was a scene in there that I had never heard before where a Ohio state congressman, when he had voted, when he pressed John Kerry, it flipped to Bush, pressed John Kerry, you know, flipped to Bush. So he called the state Kerry campaign, and they told him to be quiet about it. They didn't want it to get it out. And he felt like they needed to know that these were happening on the machines, and they weren't interested, or at least did not want to disclose it at all.
Yeah, the whole, I think, you know, probably you could call it the Bob Schrum strategy, you know, for a long, long time, the official Democratic Party strategy with regard to election fraud, not vote fraud. Vote fraud is what the Republicans want to talk about. You know, holy cow, there's an illegal alien who wants to cast a ballot. That's what they're all freaked out about, right? But election fraud, stealing elections, systematically stealing elections from caging, which the Republican Party has been operating under for 20 years now under a restraining order to prevent them from doing it, although they're doing it. And why isn't Tim Cummings being investigated for it? I don't know. You know, Karl Rove's buddy who Sarah Taylor in sworn testimony before Congress said his job was to be in charge of caging, from caging to rigging voting machines, you know, frankly. I have talked with Democratic politicians who have told me that the word from the party high mucky mucks is don't talk about this because it'll discourage people from voting, and they'll think that their vote won't count, and if they think their vote doesn't count, then they won't show up and vote. But the Republicans will show up and vote anyway, and it'll hurt the Democrats if we talk about electronic voting fraud and other kinds of voting fraud. And I think it's wrong. I think it's a mistake. I think it's a strategic blunder. I think it's one of many. And yeah, I've heard those reports too, that the Kerry campaign didn't want to know about vote fraud back in the 2004 election. I think it's a tragedy. Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, you're right to point out that the threat to our democracy comes from the Republican control and takeover of our fourth estate, particularly the public airwaves, as in Alabama. An objective, you know, and a proactive fourth estate, it obviously it's a necessity to having a functioning democracy, but ours, you know, has been essentially turned into a propaganda arm for the corporate crime syndicate that's basically run, as far as I can tell, by an illicit Republican Party. So, in effect, we have no checks, and since they also control the judiciary and can therefore, you know, get away with stealing votes as well, I mean, if anyone hasn't seen the documentary Orwell Rolls in His Grave and The Hunting of the President, they really should go out and get a copy and view it, because it shows also how these Republican political criminals imprisoned Susan McDougal because she wouldn't lie under oath about Clinton.
Yep.
And, you know, ultimately we're going to have to buy our own media to get our democracy back, I'm afraid.
Well, step by step, yeah. It's, you know, and there were, at the time in Alabama, there was no progressive talk radio. There still isn't in Alabama, to the best of my knowledge. And so it was all right wing, and it was all going after Siegelman and in favor of Riley. And to that extent, let me just say, you know, if you want progressive talk radio to exist and survive in your community, it's doing very well in a lot of cities across the United States. There's a few where it's a little dicey. And the bottom line, the thing that makes the difference, is whether or not there are advertisers. And so, you know, marching is great, demonstrating is great, but the most important thing you can do is every time you walk into a store and buy something, say to them, you know, you really should be advertising on the local progressive show, or the local progressive station, or you know, I listen all the time to, you know, KLSD, or I listen all the time to K-Talk, or I listen all the time to WTKG, or, you know, give them the call letters of the station and say, you ought to consider advertising there. And if you have friends who are in business and who are, I mean, this is the lifeblood of this business, frankly. And conservative talk radio went through tough times 10, 15 years ago with regard to advertising, and they got it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Dr. Rick Scarborough, president of Vision America, visionamerica.org, restoring the original American vision. He was one of the folks featured on CNN's God's Warriors series as one of the Christian warriors of God that Christiana Amanpour was profiling, is with us. Rick Scarborough, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you today, Tom. Why is that? Is that lions I hear in the background?
Lions?
Yeah, am I being thrown into the lion's den?
Are you feeling like Daniel today?
A little bit.
Well, what can I say? There's probably a lot of things we disagree on. I suspect as Christians there's a lot of things we agree on too, Rick.
You know, the fairest treated I've been lately has been on some of the Air America programs. I've appreciated the opportunity to express my views to a broader audience.
Well, it's good to know. You're embarking on a 70-week campaign, conducting one-day crusades across the nation.
Right.
And talking about, you say the focus of the events is motivating the church to vote their values. I'm assuming by voting Christian values, you're talking about, for example, Matthew 25 or the Sermon on the Mount. You're talking about caring for the homeless, caring for the poor, caring for those who have no health insurance, all the things that the Democrats are working for and the Republicans are so working aggressively against.
Well, we're calling on people to advocate life from the time, moment of conception, sovereignly chosen by God, until the time that God chooses to call someone home. And part of our mission statement for this effort has been that some of those typical Republican ideals have to be challenged. I'm not for government giveaways. I'm not for the government using its power to rob people to give money from the wealthy to the poor, if that's what you're advocating. But I do believe there's a role for government to play to make sure there's a level playing field and to give people opportunity.
I'm not sure what I understand what all that means. Are you suggesting that in a democracy, in a democratic republic like we have, constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, that if we the people collectively decide that we want to follow the values that are laid out in both the Old and New Testament, in Judaism and Christianity, and every other religion of the world, arguably, and care for the least among us collectively, by taxing ourselves and using those taxes to pay for example, a national health care system, that that's somehow something you would oppose?
I would oppose if it's a way of coercing people to certain behaviors. Our progressive income tax at the present time is an ungodly, wicked scheme, I believe, to force behaviors. And I can illustrate that. My tax monies are usurped for me. Well, perhaps income tax was a poor choice, but taxes in general in this country. I pay enormous property taxes every year, as most people do, and especially in the state of Texas, that goes to a secular school system that literally brainwashes children and taught my children things that we don't believe and didn't teach at home. You know,
But you have the option of putting your children in a private school.
If all the liberal talk about value-neutral education was in effect, I would be more comfortable with it than I am with an educational system that literally teaches antithetical to the Word of God.
Well, you have the option of putting your children in a private school.
But I don't have the option of letting that money go with them.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, we live in the society where you have already taken a bite out of the candy bar, as it were. I mean, the metaphor that I use is if you walk into a 7-Eleven and you pick up a chocolate bar, a Hershey bar, and you got a dollar in your pocket, at that moment, that Hershey bar is still the property of 7-Eleven and the dollar is still your dollar. But the minute you take a bite into that Hershey bar, even if you haven't paid for it yet, you can no longer say that that dollar in your pocket is your money. And I would submit to you that as long as you are using the public infrastructure, and particularly as the head of a large nonprofit which doesn't pay taxes, I mean, you're using a lot of the public infrastructure. You're using our public roads. You're using our court system. You're using our financial system. You're using the protections of the banks. I mean, you know, obviously people who work for you are probably by and large products of public education. They know how to read and write. You have already bitten into that candy bar. You're using all these things, and so you can't say that it's your tax dollars that are being taken or your money that is being, by being a member of our society, you've already agreed to be a part of that, to have paid for it.
Mark, your reasoning is riddled with error. Every employee at Vision America pays personal taxes. They pay their fair share.
Does your corporation pay taxes on accrued revenue?
Our country decided some time ago that nonprofits would exist, and that people could opt and choose which ones they would support with a free will, and that rather than the government decide what nonprofits would exist, people would decide by their gifts.
I understand that quite well. I've been on the board of a nonprofit for 27 years. I absolutely understand that. And our government decided that if a nonprofit, and the nonprofits are vital, the churches and educational institutions are vital, and therefore we're going to all collectively, the rest of us, pick up part of the tab for you. Pick up part of your tab. The cost of the fire protection for your facility, the cost of the police protection, I'm paying for that.
Wait, we're doing that because we think what you're doing is vital.
But the trade-off is that you don't get to play in politics in exchange for that.
You're not paying any more than every employee at Vision America is paying. We all pay our fair share of taxes. The organization...
No, I'm saying Vision America is not paying it.
Well, no, it's not. And thank God for it. And we're able to do a whole lot of things because of that.
But there's a trade-off. I mean, I'm broadcasting right now from a Clear Channel radio station. Clear Channel's paying their taxes on the profit that they're making off this radio show, and those taxes go to pay for the police and fire protection of the building that I'm in. Your building is being paid for. The fire and protection is not being paid for by the revenues that you're bringing in.
Well,
it's being paid for by everybody else.
And
the deal that we made with you for that, and the deal that we made with the nonprofit that I'm on the board of, the New England Salem Children's Village, is that in exchange for doing good work, you don't get to play in the political realm. And here you are starting a 70-week campaign to try and tell people how to vote. I think that's wrong.
Well, but we're not telling people how to vote. We're telling them to vote their values, so then they choose how those values apply.
Okay, and your narrow, you're also very narrowly defining your values. For example, you write today on your blog, about the whole Larry Craig affair, which I think we probably both agree is a human tragedy.
Yes, it is.
And you say, if such allegations were to surface regarding a Democrat, while doubtlessly the talking heads would find it noteworthy, no real damage would occur. After all, homosexuals are major players in the Democratic coalition, along with unions, feminists, and environmentalists, etc. I mean, this is just gay bashing.
But go ahead and read the rest of it. If you're gonna consider that
sure.
gay bashing, I went ahead and bashed Republican parties who use value voters in large measure as just another constituency that they wink at and nod at and throw us a bone, but they turn around and ignore us the rest of the time. I'm an equal opportunity confronter of what I believe to be wrong on both sides of the block. I condemned in that email both Democrats and Republicans, if you read it all.
So, well, your point is that you're trying to bring the Republican Party back to a totally anti-gay position. Let's purge them of all gays, right?
The point is bring back values. Some are right and some are wrong. I happen to believe homosexual behavior is a sin. I believe that homosexuals are loved by God, but their activity, just like those who commit fornication, is condemned by God, and I don't make any bones about that. I don't hate gays, but I do believe that the activity, their behavior is wrong, and I make no, I don't apologize.
I understand that, and I would submit to you that the majority of Americans consider the position that you just made to be a very bigoted position. That it's a statement of bigotry. That if people are gay, if people are born gay, and we know all across the animal kingdom that this happens, if people are born gay, then attacking somebody for being gay is no different than attacking them for having black skin.
My soul, Tom, did you say across the animal kingdom? I live on a ranch.
Yes.
I've never seen any of these animals out here behave that way.
Well, then you haven't been looking very closely.
Well, I've birthed...
Talk to any zoologist. Gay behavior happens right across the animal kingdom, particularly among mammals, but you even find it in non-mammalian species. We got ducks living behind our house.
Animal behavior.
Pardon?
So what you're advocating... is animal behavior?
No, what I'm saying is that we have a long tradition in the United States of embracing diversity and saying we're all in this together and we're all part of the human family and it's not just love the sinner and hate the sin.
Well, let's talk about your totalitarian views. So what you'd like now is to get government to pass legislation to put me in jail for thinking what I think or preaching what
no.
I preach.
No, I never suggested that, and I never would, frankly.
Are you in favor?
Although I do think that your tax-exempt status should be in danger. But, you know, for involving yourself with the Republican Party. But no, I just think that this is bigotry. I think it's a tragedy.
It's not bigotry. I believe it's compassion, because when you tell people the truth, you show the greatest form of love there is.
Okay, and I'll agree with you on that statement. People can read all about it over at visionamerica.org. Rick Scarborough, thanks for being with us, Rick.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Every time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim... I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. It's the Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third. That a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage, connubial narcs, ever vigilant and patriotic patriarchs. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution against people who want to get married. One summer evening when my woman was doing laundry, I shared a six-pack with an old John Bircher. And oh so wisely he imparted an ancient quandary to ponder. He said it's nature versus legislature. Are people born gay or do they turn gay just to piss off Dick Army? We're an army of dicks with a militant stance.
He's traveling the country.
All right, 22 minutes past the hour. Some bumpers just shouldn't play out all the way. Welcome back. David Vitter versus Larry Craig. What's going on with that? By the way, this is a clip from Christiana Amanpour's CNN special. This is Rick Scarborough preaching.
Holding church rallies from now until Election Day 2008.
Here's the danger you need to see.
Like many of his Christian counterparts.
Anyhow, I guess I cued past it, but the point, he said it's a sin not to vote if you're a Christian. And, well, I don't know. It's not something I recall Jesus talking about, frankly. But there's been some question about why it is that, Larry Craig.
Naughty boy. Bad boy. A naughty boy. Nasty. Bad. Naughty boy.
Why Larry Craig is being called to resign from the Republican Party, whereas David Vitter, the Republican from Louisiana, another Republican who was involved in another sex scandal, he was, getting it on with a prostitute, which, by the way, is a crime in Washington, D.C., why he was not called to resign and, in fact, received thunderous applause, a standing ovation from Senate GOP colleagues during a policy field lunch a few days after his admission. Now, why would David Vitter get a standing ovation from his Republican colleagues and Larry Craig be asked to resign? I would say, first and foremost, Larry Craig is accused of doing something that has to do with being gay, and that just makes Republicans crazy. But secondly, I would say that there's a strategic element at work here. Larry Craig, first of all, if Larry Craig had been a Democrat, they would have been screaming for his head. But Larry Craig is from a state, David Vitter is from a state, Louisiana, with a Democratic governor, Kathleen Blanco. And if David Vitter were to resign, this Republican in the United States Senate would be replaced by a Democrat, in all probability. Whereas if Larry Craig, the Republican from Idaho, resigns, you've got a Republican governor in Idaho, Larry Craig will be replaced by a Republican who will have, the better part of some 400 and some odd days, a little over a year, to prepare for the next campaign. So let's get moving here. And it is the mantra of the Republicans is, let's get this thing going. By the way, just a quick heads up, wanted to call this out. This is just absolutely great. This is a summary of a piece of legislation that was just introduced by James. Well, not just introduced. Actually, it was introduced back in March, March 5th of this year. But hopefully this thing is going to take on some new legs, given the saber rattling, shall we say, of the Bush administration. It is Senate Bill 759. It prohibits funds from being obligated or expended for military operations or activities within or above Iran's territory or within Iran's territorial waters, except pursuant to a specific congressional authorization enacted after the date of the enactment of this act. And then there's some reasonable exemptions. If they attack us, we get to attack back. No problem. Or if we're in hot pursuit of forces engaged, outside who then flee into Iran, we can go into Iran. Yeah, there's a few exemptions. But by and large, it would say, George, sorry, you are not the war czar. You're not the war king. And a fine thing it is. Carol in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Carol, I've got about a minute before we're going to take a break at the bottom of the hour. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, I'm just calling in about we have German Shepherd that the vet told us was gay. We tried to mate him. He was not interested in female dogs. They took blood tests, and he had more female hormones than male hormones. And he was the sweetest dog, so motherly, and carried the ferrets around in his mouth like they were his babies. He was just an awesome dog. So there's proof right there that it does run in the animal kingdom.
No, absolutely. I mean, any zoologist can tell you this. Any biologist can tell you this. But that's great. You had a gay dog. What was the dog's name?
Bear.
Dare?
Bear.
Oh, yeah, Bear. Bear.
Bear, because he used to growl like a baby bear when we first got him.
Oh, isn't that cute? Well, Carol, thanks for sharing the story of your gay dog with us. It's much appreciated. Thanks for listening to KPHX. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-303-2270. A lot on the table today here. Pretty much any topic you want to get into, we can get into. I think we've touched a lot of territory. And we'll also give you just a short news update, too, as soon as we come back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is from WESH, a local television station down in Daytona Beach, Florida. And I'm not, you know, I'm not sure if I should be creeped out about this or not. It's members of the 1st Battalion, 265th Air Defense Artillery, have been mobilized. Now, actually, before I share the story with you, I should probably just, you know, give a very short setup, and that is that after the Civil War in the 1870s, we decided that never again were we going to have the U.S. military operate against American civilians on American soil. And so a law was passed called the Posse Comitatus Act that made it illegal for the federal government to use its militia, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, against U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. That was repealed. That was repealed with the passage of the Military Commissions Act back in the last time the Republicans controlled the House and Senate, essentially. And here we have now this news story, and this may be totally benign, maybe no big deal, or it could be something that we really all need to be, you know, paying attention to. So I just raise it so we can keep our eyes open. Members of the 101st, again, this is the story from WESH. It's over on their website, WESH.com. Members of the 1st Battalion, 265th Air Defense Artillery, have mobilized and are on a plane headed to Fort Bliss, then for federal active duty in the U.S. Capital Region. That would be Washington, D.C. The troops will be deployed for a year. Jessica Ward, whose father is being deployed, said, "It's going to be all right. It's okay if he helps people and everything, and it's his job. He's got to do it. He's just got to go with it." Jessica speaks for many when she talks about her father's deployment. Michael Ward and company are leaving for a year, and that weighs heavily on families. The 265th is part of Operation Noble Eagle. They are ordered by the president to the nation's capital, where they will operate high-tech weapon systems against any potential air threat. Now, if that's the beginning and end of it, it may well make perfect sense. Make perfect sense. On the other hand, what if that's not the beginning and end of it? As I said, I don't know. I'm getting a lot of very concerned emails about this kind of stuff, though, I'll tell you. David in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, David, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. We were talking about Larry Craig a little bit and David Vitter.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think Republicans are so upset with Larry Craig and not with David Vitter is David Vitter was utilizing the capitalist system to have his sexual needs satisfied. And, you know, Larry Craig is a little bit too much free love for them.
He wasn't paying to play.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one, David. Thank you very much. Bill in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to give you a little more information on the Governor Siegelman situation.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Don since 1969, and a political activist myself. He used to be the political director of the Machinist Union's Legislative and Political Action Department. In any event, the one thing that he didn't discuss was the fact that I think I'd have to check my notes, but I think it was a state attorney general that ruled that Alabama law doesn't provide for a recount, so you couldn't
right.
even have a recount.
That's right.
And yeah. I'm not sure that's true or not, but the main thing is I think they went after Don for two reasons. The most important reason, he was the most most popular Democrat in the state and probably the only Democrat that was any threat to Republicans in that state, so they wanted to do away with him. And they did a very fine job of politically assassinating him. Secondly, what started this whole thing off was the fact that he wanted a lottery in the state, and all of the money would go to pay for a free college education for anyone, any student in the state of Alabama. And that's when Abramoff and Rove got involved. You know, it's the whole Texas deal all over again kind of stuff.
Oh, because they didn't want the lottery money going to free education. They wanted it going into the pockets of their buddies in the mob.
That's about right. So Don, as a matter of fact, Scorsese donated money to the lottery campaign, and that's when he got involved in this whole thing. The other thing is, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any stretch of the imagination, and I've known Senator Leahy since he was the Attorney General in Vermont, and helped him get elected to the United States Senate the first time, and you know, we're on a first name basis, and I've communicated all of this to him earlier, and you know, got a response back from him. And when I say earlier, I mean before he was ever found guilty, this Siegelman found guilty and sentenced. And I'm not sure anything came of it. And the reason I say I'm not a conspiracy theorist is because I think Senator Sessions had some involvement in this whole affair as well. And I'm not sure Senator Leahy really wants to dig into that.
Wants to go after his colleague. That's interesting. Well, you know, I think it's the House that is supposed to be investigating it right now. We'll see where this goes, Bill, but DonSiegelman.org, you can get the information.
John Conyers, from another angle and another friend, has gotten all this information several months ago and trying to go after it as well.
Yeah, and that's the appropriate venue. Bill, thanks a lot for the heads up. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Richard in Riverside, California. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. I'm kind of nervous. I like your show, and I agree exactly what you say about, you know, is homosexuality, are you born that way? I say yes, I agree with you. I think you can go back to Genesis. I don't think if you ever mentioned Genesis, where Adam actually... God put Adam to sleep, I believe, and took one of his ribs to make woman.
In one of the two creation stories in Genesis, yeah.
And my view is sexuality is only here on Earth. If someone is born with a proclivity for homosexual behavior, or someone's born with a congenital defect, I'm not saying this is a defect, homosexuality is a defect. I'm just saying that people are born the way they are born.
Yeah, no, I get your point, Richard. And that, you know, without using the word defect, my point was people are born the way they're born. And if they're born with a certain skin color, or if they're born of a certain gender, or if they're born into a certain religion, or if they're born, well, that's a little more arguable, I suppose, or if they're born with a certain sexual preference, that, you know, we need to honor that rather than trash that. And frankly, I think it is highly unchristian to try and turn that into a political wedge that can be used to promote political agendas. Ron in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing? Well, first of all, just really quick comment here. I don't remember Jesus saying much about homosexuality.
He never spoke of homosexuality.
Covenant.
Yeah, it is not discussed in the four Gospels.
Right, and Tom, also, my main point here today was about the war, and the war with Iran. The way we've positioned ourselves as far as the military strategical aspect is concerned, if you look at a globe, it's almost like they've tried to corner Iran from the get-go. Going into this, I mean, Iran is probably the most powerful country in that little area there. Mm-hmm. And I just think that they've kind of, this has been the ultimate plan from the beginning. after Afghanistan and then Iraq, and the only place they haven't went to, I believe, is maybe Turkey or Pakistan would be one of the other countries they haven't invaded. But I think Iran, it's from the get-go, they've been trying to do that. I don't know what you're...
Yeah, well, we have such good relations with Turkey and Pakistan. I mean, they're basically allies. We don't need to invade them.
Right.
Plus, Turkey isn't, like, super oil-rich, and neither is Pakistan, for that matter.
Uh-huh. My last point was on terrorism. Now, I'm not saying that terrorism doesn't exist, because I think it does. But main point here is that the border down there in Mexico, and I'm sure you've heard this before, it's been open for all these years. All these Hispanic people are coming across. I mean, why hasn't something really happened in all this time? If there's so many terrorists that are running around in this country that we have to have this wiretapping and the surveillance and all this, why hasn't something major happened? I know 9/11 happened, but other than that, there hasn't been anything else.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I mean, look at you had a very, very active conflict going on in Ireland, you know, between the IRA and the Orange Bunch and, you know, between the Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland. And, it was, I mean, the IRA was taking the fight to England, you know, who were back in their proxies, as it were. And things were blowing up all over the place. And the British were like, okay, we're going to deal with these people as criminals. And we're going to get through this. And we are not going to be terrified, and we are not going to change our laws, and we are not going to give up democracy, and we'll get through this. In Germany, the Bader-Meinhof gang. In Italy, Aldo Moro, the prime minister, was kidnapped and murdered, you know, by terrorists. And they didn't say, okay, that's it, no more civil rights.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad.
one 866 303 2270, our phone number, airamerica.com, the website for our blog, tomhartman.com, to participate in our message boards or find the links to our free live chat room. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line, listening on KKZN. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I'd like to comment on the Democrats' reactions about election problems and make 3 points. First, the Fradycrats, you know, they always make the most negative and wimpy choices based on the fear that somebody is going to react negatively. They never act boldly, it seems. And wimpiness, and not speaking about election fraud, is the thing that's allowed fraud to happen and grow. I give lectures on this stuff, and the response that I get from the audience is very different than, you know, I get people come up and say, well, here are the points. If you speak up, people will do something. They're not going to deal with a problem they don't know exists.
Well, and this is, you know, and great examples of this, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. I mean, we have a long history of politicians who finally found their voices. And uh-huh. And when they did, they discovered that the public was there with them.
Yes. And then, second, if you speak up and say, hey, the Republicans are doing vote fraud, guess what? Instead of people not voting, they won't vote Republican.
Right. And I think that, you know, frankly, you know, we had this conversation with Mark Crispin Miller just before the last election, and he was actually predicting that the Republicans were going to take the House and Senate because he had so carefully and thoroughly documented all the various ways that the Republicans were engaging in election fraud, from caging, I mean, the rigging machines was the smallest. I mean, you know, it doesn't even have to be in the equation. The machines could be totally just fine, and still he said, you know, they're stealing 5 million votes.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, what can we do? And he said, we need to get 6 million votes, extra votes out there. And in fact, that's what we did. And this election, they're probably going to steal 6 million. We're going to have to get 7 million votes out there. And I think it's fine to talk about the fact that the Republicans are engaged in election fraud. They have been for years and years. They've been under court order not to do it, and they're defying the court order. And we need to point it out, and I think Democratic politicians should be pointing it out. Although, you know, we do have this one case of Don Siegelman, he pointed it out, and bang, he finds his butt in prison.
But he's there out by himself. And that then, so there's the meme we should speak about. We need to reverse the meme. The meme should be, because there's election fraud, more people vote. Because if you study the issue, you can only throw the votes by a certain amount. Just as Mark Crispin Miller said, it's going to be 6 million votes. We need to get 7. Well, if we have more people voting, the fraud, if it occurred, would be that much more noticeable, because we're saying, well, hey, the poll said that, this person is going to win by 20 million. They lost by 5. You have to have enormous fraud when more people turn out.
Yeah. Well said, Jeff. Thank you.
More people should vote.
There you go. Amen. Alan in Beverly Hills, California. Hey, Alan.
Hi. Two points. One, the Congress, Democrats, shouldn't give Bush another nickel for this war. The only exception I might say is if Bush would agree to sign the $25 or $35 billion over the next 10 years to ensure the children, maybe. Right now he's planning to veto it if it even comes across his desk. But the other point is, I'm 65 and I lived through Watergate. And the Democrats there, not only did Nixon and Agnew resign, but Attorney General Mitchell went to prison. Secretary of Treasury Stans went to prison. Nixon's right-hand men, Ehrlichman and Haldeman, went to prison. And they went to prison for crimes, but they don't compare. They don't compare to the serious crimes over the last 5-6 years of this administration. And I can't understand why the Democrats don't have a measly 218 votes to impeach these guys.
Yeah.
And it would be a big thing on the newspapers. House impeaches Bush and Cheney. Trial begins in 4 to 8 weeks. And if it goes on for a year, year and a half, or whatever, fine, just like Milosevic.
It won't go on for a year, year and a half. I mean, that was a whole different thing. An impeachment trial, the trial would be in the Senate. But the debate about whether or not to have articles of impeachment voted through the House of Representatives,
right,
presumably would take no more than a week in the House of Representatives.
Right.
I mean, each member of the House will have an opportunity to have their say, and
right,
then a vote is taken. I mean, this isn't rocket science. And frankly, in my opinion, even if the vote loses, at least there was a vote, and it's on the record
that
the representatives of we the people of the United States are offended by, at the very least offended, I mean, that's the mildest language that I can come up with, are offended by the concept that the president does not believe in democracy, is subverting the democratic process, has lied us into a war that is not that dissimilar from Hitler's attacking Poland, and now maybe preparing to lie us into another one. And I think, frankly, it's one of the few things that might slow him down. But your point is well made, Alan. And similarly, this now there's the saying, oh, we want another $50 billion. And oddly enough, according to Fox News, if you want to, which should be called Fox Opinion, but nonetheless, they're reporting that Gates, the Secretary of Defense, didn't realize that he was going to ask for an extra $50 billion. So the White House is really pumping this thing. Saida in Portland, Oregon, got about a minute before we've got to take a break here at the top of the hour. What's up?
I'll try to be fast. I'm a lifelong, very active Democrat, marched in the Vietnam War against the Vietnam War. Really lost faith in the process over the past 20 years, and then you inspired me to become active again. Your tag, your it challenge caused me to become the precinct committee person for my precinct. As I talk to my neighbors, I find well over half of them really, really, really want impeachment. I've been calling Congressman Blumenauer's office literally for months about impeachment, and initially just got shoved off. As we've gotten more recent, they've been not going to have a chance here, huh?
Yeah, no, I get your point that Earl Blumenauer is ignoring your call for impeachment.
And I think he will not meet with us. I've been trying to meet with him for 4 weeks, and he will not do that. And he's not had a town hall meeting, and he will not have one.
Yeah, well, the message, you just got the message out, Saida, and hopefully Earl Blumenauer will respond. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Oh, man. I'm just looking at this story over at Think Progress, the Center for American Progress. Fox News bashes desperate, ambitious, single mother Katie Couric for traveling to Iraq. Oh, man. It's what a double standard. Chris Hayes is with us. He's with one of the publications that doesn't have a double standard, The Nation, thenation.com, the website. And, Chris, welcome to the program, first
of all. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You wrote a piece in the August 27, 2007 issue titled The NAFTA Superhighway. And I think probably most of our listeners have some familiarity with it, whether it's watching Lou Dobbs hyperventilate about it on TV on CNN, or whether it's Jerome Corsi actually is running around. In fact, he came on this program and talked about it about 6-8 months ago. And there's a whole lot of concern about this giant conspiracy to unite the United States and Canada into one giant country and do away with America. And it sort of sounds like what I used to hear from the John Birch Society when I was 13 years old.
Well, they're still active.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
this is actually a new crusade of theirs.
Yeah. So tell me, first of all, you know, what's the deal here?
You know, the deal is, you know, I first heard about this in January this year. I was having breakfast with a friend who mentioned it offhand, and when he told me about it, he kind of laid out the main sort of contours of the mythology, and I get into him in the story. You know, there's going to be this. He said, "Have you heard about this highway they're building? It's going to go from Mexico to Canada through the gut of the heartland. It's going to be 4 football fields wide. It's going to be, you know, it's going to go through all this farmland. It's going to be a privatized toll road. It's, you know, it's going to carry passenger rail and trucks and freight and all this stuff." And I thought, no, I haven't heard about that, but if that's true, that's crazy that I haven't. And so I started digging around and couldn't really answer the question of whether the thing existed or not, just the internet was sort of so confusing. So I set out to try to settle it. And there's 2 basic answers. One is that there's no such thing as a NAFTA superhighway. You know, it is a myth. And when I say that, what I mean is that when grandmothers at an Iowa town hall meeting ask a Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney about the NAFTA superhighway, what they're talking about and what they're imagining is that they're going to peer out their windows and see bulldozers in the cornfields. And it's not going to happen. I mean, a highway on the scale that the mythology describes would have to go through a very attenuated, complicated bureaucratic process.
Right.
Be the largest.
The Fifth Amendment, you'd have a lot of eminent domain stuff going on there. But there is already a highway. I mean, there's I-35.
Right. That's the other thing, is that one of the things that triggered all this was a map put up by this organization called North America's Super Corridor Organization, based in Dallas, Texas, that, you know, advocates for, and what they advocate for isn't particularly, you know, noble or high-minded. They basically want the government to subsidize improvements that'll help, you know, their business members get stuff from point A to point B faster. But they put up this map that just showed I-35, and then below I-35 down into Mexico and extending up Winnipeg and up to Toronto in the north, and people saw this map and freaked out. It started sort of passing around the internet as the blueprint for the, quote, NAFTA superhighway. But it was just a map of I-35 with some connecting roads added on that, you know. Yeah, so that's the sort of source of a lot of the hysteria.
Yeah, now, at the same time, though, in Waco, Texas, back a couple of years ago, I think it was in 2005, you had George Bush and Stephen Martin and the Prime Minister of Canada and Vicente Fox, the President of Mexico, got together and they signed this thing, the Security and Prosperity Partnership of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually an official website for it, spp.gov. I mean, it's an official government website.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at it, and it's one of those things, you know, it's like NAFTA and CAFTA and the WTO and all this stuff. They were sold to us by both George Bush and Bill Clinton as something that was, you know, it was going to be a good thing. It's going to enhance trade, blah, 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 blah. Turns out it's a good thing if you're a transnational corporation.
Right.
Turns it's a good thing if you're a multimillionaire investor. But if you happen to be a worker in any of those countries, you're screwed.
Right.
And so there's a lot of us who are looking at the Security and Prosperity Partnership of the Americas, and you know, the meme is out there about the NAFTA superhighway, when in fact, as you you and I, you know, agree there already is a highway that does reach from the ports of Mexico all the way up into Canada. There's a series, you know, it's a series of highway systems. And some of it may end up toll road or not, who knows. But I mean, we're still moving in this direction of fewer and fewer restrictions on trans-border corporate activity that will thus enhance corporate profits, and yet greater and greater restrictions on human trans-border activity that make it more and more difficult for people to cross borders that kind of thing. I mean,
right? I think you've hit the nail on the head of the sort of inherent contradiction there. And I think one of the things I tried to communicate in the article is that the anxiety produced by the NAFTA superhighway and focused on the NAFTA superhighway isn't some in some cases it's born of a real kind of paranoia and nationalism, but in a lot of cases it's born of a totally legitimate and well-grounded anxiety and distrust of the machinations of the U.S. government and other governments in setting a kind of agenda for, global trade and kind of neoliberal capitalism.
Now, here at the same time, this is in today's Houston Chronicle. Okay, it's an AP story by Jesse Holland. And the Teamsters Union said today, this is today's paper, said today it will ask a federal appeals court to block the Bush administration's plan to begin allowing Mexican trucks to carry cargo anywhere in the United States. The union said has been told by officials in the Transportation Department's Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration that the first Mexican trucks will be coming across the border on Saturday. And the Teamsters president, Jim Hoffa, says, what a slap in the face to American workers opening the highway to dangerous trucks on Labor Day weekend, one of the busiest driving weekends of the year. We don't need a North American super highway corridor or whatever. All they have to do is just say, trucks from Mexico can come into the United States. They don't have to meet our standards. They don't have to, the workers aren't labor standards. The trucks aren't pollution standards. No problem. And that's what they've done.
Right. Yeah, exactly. In some senses, the NAFTA highway is a distraction from.
Well, it's apparently it's a done deal starting this weekend.
Well, the Teamsters and other people won a big victory insofar as originally it was a far more ambitious program, and then when there was a backlash, they had to pare it back, and they turned it into what they're calling this pilot program. The pilot program, I think, consists of about 300 trucks.
Right, but the pilot program will last what six until nobody's paying attention. And
right.
Then
that's the idea, is to get a foot in the door, as it were. The agenda here is clearly to drive in the same direction as NAFTA has, which is to, I mean, what you have in the SPP, which is sort of ironic, is that essentially what we're doing is we're imposing our kind of security standards on the other two countries, which is a reason why a lot of progressives in Canada are really up in arms about the SPP.
Right, Big Brother comes to Canada.
What's that?
Big Brother comes to Canada.
Right, exactly. So all the rigmarole that, say, a European visitor now goes through at the U.S. border with the U.S. visit program and fingerprints and pictures, et cetera, we essentially want to export that to Canada, Mexico, and say, look, you need to, live up to our security standards and wage your own war on terror at the borders. At the same time that we're imposing that, we're then saying also that we want to sync up the regulatory frameworks of the three countries. And you can imagine that under the aegis of the Bush administration, syncing up regulatory frameworks is going to mean deregulation.
Right. It's going to mean everything drops to the lowest common denominator.
Right. That's exactly right. So you have this. So we're saying more. Essentially, it's a combination of more security and less regulation. Which I mean,
right. It's harder for people. It's easier for corporations.
That's
that's the direction we've been moving.
Right.
Well, largely ever since Reagan first started this process, but really Bush Sr., with fast track authority and most favored nation status and embracing all these kinds of things and aggressively promoting it. But Clinton really kicked the door wide open in, 86, 87 with NAFTA and GATT. And now, George W. Bush, I mean, it's almost like this series of four administrations and the Congresses associated with them have all just been totally dancing to the tunes of the transnational corporations and to hell with the American worker.
Right. I mean, that's and you see it reflected in who has influence in Washington. You see it reflected in the nature of the debates we have where, people.
So the bottom line here is that the Birchies and the Corsies and, the Birch Society bunch and the Jerome Corsies of the world, I mean, there is something to be paranoid about. It's just that they've hallucinated something much bigger and much more specific than is real.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
That's the bottom line. Yeah, okay. Chris Hayes, you can read all about it in The Nation. TheNation.com, the website. And the article is called The NAFTA Superhighway by Christopher Hayes. Chris, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with us with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. She's the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center and also creates the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org. Hey, Christy.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. I hope you're well.
I am, and I got to tell you, you know, I leave, everything is calm, everything is peaceful. I go away for 2 weeks, Karl Rove resigns, Tony Snow resigns, we've got Alberto Gonzalez resigning, and then we've got, you know, Larry Craig doing a George Michael in the bathrooms at the airport. What happened?
Yeah, I don't know. It's August. It's a slow, it's the month when nobody's paying attention, so all the Republican stuff is going to go flying, you know.
It's just got wacky.
I've actually even heard the rumor flying around the blogosphere that, you know, that Alberto Gonzalez, being the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, has known for several weeks about Larry Craig's situation.
And that would not surprise me.
And that his office was the source of the leak that brought this into public prominence the day after he resigned so that he could get himself off the headlines.
So basically he threw Larry Craig under the bus, if you will, in order to divert some of the Klieg light of the spotlight of attention.
Yeah, either he did or Karl Rove did, or the two of them together.
What,
yeah, I have no,
about, you
I,
know?
I have nothing to back that up other than, you know, 30 or 40 conspiracy-minded emails, but
it's a good
it
rumor.
Sure wouldn't
like
surprise
it.
Me. Yeah, I mean, these guys are so good at managing the news. They are just so good. So,
well, speaking of the Larry Craig stuff, though, I have a question for you, and I don't know if you've talked about this.
What was that name you said?
Speaking of Larry Craig?
Naughty boy. Bad boy. A naughty boy. Nasty. Bad. Naughty boy.
Ah, yes. Good old Larry Craig, yes. This is like the Dean Scream. I mean, you know, this is a gift to the media, you know.
And it's one that just keeps on giving, you know. It's good stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Naughty boy.
Absolutely.
I think it's very strange, though, that Larry Craig, of course, we all know what happened, but he was busted soliciting sex, illegal sex, in a bathroom from a guy. And all of the Republicans have basically come out to vilify him. He's off of all of his committee posts. They want him to resign. Everyone is on the right is horrified, shocked, and he must be punished immediately. But then you think about just last month, David Vitter. And there was a congressman who was busted soliciting sex from a prostitute, but it was a female. It just seems like there's this incredible double standard. And the day after David Vitter was busted, he went to a big Republican luncheon and got a standing ovation from his colleagues.
Well, you see, David Vitter was engaging in commerce, and Republicans like commerce.
Okay, so it was sexual capitalism.
That's right. You know, Larry Craig was looking for a freebie. How dare he?
Such a communist, you know?
Right. Now, I think that, you know, yes, I think that there, obviously there's a large element of not just homophobia, but of bigotry. I mean, the Republican Party has made bigotry one of their main mantras. And so, of course, they have to take the run with this flag. But I think that there's also a political equation here that we ignore at our own peril. And that is that if David Vitter, the Republican from Louisiana, resigns, the Democratic governor of Louisiana will replace him with a Democrat in the Senate. And
right.
So no Republican would ever call for him to resign. Whereas the exact opposite is the case. I mean, the hyper opposite is the case with Larry Craig. If he resigns, the Republican governor of Idaho will replace him with a Republican who will then have 12, 13, 14 months to make him or herself, you know, ingratiate themselves with the public and make themselves very electable in the next election.
See, that makes sense. I don't like it, but it does make more sense then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really ultimately the bottom line in terms of Republican strategy. In terms of the media, it's a whole different thing. The surge, how's the surge doing?
This is interesting. We got a leaked report from the GAO, the report that's supposed to be out next week. The Washington Post got an advanced copy. And the GAO has found that Iraq has failed to meet all but three of those 18 benchmarks that Congress said the Iraq government had to meet in order for the surge to be a success and to go on. If you remember, just a few months ago, the Bush administration was saying they'd met eight. But then when you actually looked at it, the eight turned out to all be a lot of hot air and a lot of, well, they thought about doing this, so we'll give it to them. When you really look at it, they've only met three, and of those three,
you still
two
there, Christy? I've just lost the audio.
I'm sorry?
No, you're still there. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Keep on talking.
So of those benchmarks, you know, two have been partially met, one has not been met at all, and they're saying that, you know, the capabilities of the Iraqi security forces, not improved. Mm-hmm. The key legislation that said that they had to start spending money, that $10 billion towards reconstruction, not been spent. So
and now we hear Gates is saying, what, we're going to ask for $50 billion? I didn't know that.
I know, $50 billion.
I mean, what's going on? What's going on in the administration? You have the White House saying they're going to ask for $50 billion and the Secretary of Defense doesn't know about it?
Exactly. I think that they are just struggling and they're all getting very afraid. It's September, you know, the month we've all been waiting for.
Yeah, it could be that they're putting into place a political strategy against the Democrats and they just didn't bother to tell the Secretary of Defense because he's in charge of military stuff.
Because that's a good way to run a roller, you know?
Yeah, right. AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's our best of the rest of the news segment. Every Thursday, we check in with some of the real experts out there in the tubes, in the internets, not the trucks, the tubes, and find out, you know, what their thoughts are on what's happening in the news and what's happening, really the rest of the news, the news that might not necessarily be making the mainstream, or a take on the news that goes beyond the mainstream perspective of it. Faiz Shakir is with us with the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. He's the research director at the Center for American Progress. Is it Faz?
Faz, like jazz.
Faz, like jazz. I'm sorry. Thank you so much. Faz, great to have you with us, Faz.
Yeah, thank you.
And Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com and BuzzFlash.net and numerous other sites now associated with it. Hey, Mark.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you with us, Faz. Let's start with you. What are you seeing as the biggest stories on the, you know, on the front page right now? What do you think are the things that we should be paying attention to?
Well, everybody's talking about the upcoming quote Petraeus report, which we know is now going to be authored by the White House. There's a whole variety of angles to this story. I think the most interesting being that, you know, the government accountability office has this report, the Washington Post leaked. But what was interesting is not that the GAO reported that there were that the Iraqi government is failing and we're not meeting any of the benchmarks, et cetera. We all know that. But what was interesting about the story is that apparently the administration, the Bush administration, is trying to water down the report. And not only water it down, but now they're trying to ditch the benchmarks altogether. They're trying to back away from them. They're saying we never supported them. They're twisting and twisting reports. And this is just the latest example because, you know, they're trying to water down this particular GAO report, but they also, apparently tweaked the national intelligence estimate that came out last week that offered, quote, measurable but uneven improvements in Iraq. And so what it looks like the White House is engaging in a heavy-handed kind of tweaking of a lot of these reports that we're seeing.
Interesting. Nothing new, though, is it? I mean, you know, the White House has been doing this all along. They've been rewriting science reports and global warming and, you know, a whole, I mean, essentially standard operating procedure for them.
So it makes you recall, I think, remember the famous Downing Street memo that said that the administration was, quote, fixing the facts around the policy. Remember that one?
Yeah.
And it sounds like they're still doing that, fixing the facts around the policy.
Or the famous quote that, you guys live in a reality-based world. We make reality. I forget who said that, but one of the great neocons of our age, no doubt. Faz, thanks for your insight on that. Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash.com. Mark, I'm wondering what you see as the front page story. What's the big news?
Well, to add to that note, I think it's extremely important, and you probably talked about it, which is the Government Accounting Office report indicates little progress in Iraq, that only 3 of the 18 congressionally mandated benchmarks have been met. And I think this only further strengthens this understanding that we have a dual path going here. We have a Bush narrative, which is largely a fictional narrative, and then we have reality. And the issue is, when is the reality going to accumulate enough under the political willpower for it to break through that fictional narrative, such as what was just mentioned, the White House writing Petraeus's report? The mainstream media, for the most part, is still referring to it as Petraeus's report when he delivers his report. They don't qualify that to say written by the White House. And so the fictional narrative is, in the mainstream media, still largely the one that is being disseminated to the public. Meanwhile, the GAO issues this report today that says that it's going horribly. Only 3 of the 18 benchmarks have been met, and the White House and Pentagon dispute the GAO report. So whatever doesn't fit into their fictional narrative, they just summarily dismiss, and they wait until the next day news cycle to begin putting out their fictional narrative again.
Yeah, and we buy it, right?
We buy it because the modern-day news cycle is such that it's ahistorical for the most part. There's no time for context. There's no will for context. And it's merely a surge, if one may use that expression, of headlines without revealing to you or the viewer what preceded that the day before. So the GAO report will be lost by tomorrow.
Yeah. That's and certainly lost by next week when people start paying attention to the news again. I mean, this
well,
is Andy Card's famous.
The news will position Petraeus, the report written by the White House with political objectives in mind, and Petraeus picked for political purposes after basically the White House vetted the Pentagon of any generals who disagreed with its policies. The press will position this as Petraeus's report, which it is not going to be. I might add that I was at one of these Move On events in Northbrook, Illinois. They were throughout the country on the 28th, I think, as most listeners know, and Jan Schakowsky had just been to Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky to D.C., and she mentioned, this was written up actually in the Washington Post, and she reconfirmed it, that Petraeus said, while they lunched on lobster, and she said they had a gilded menu and all of this in the green zone, that he expected the troops to be there for another 10 years.
Wow. Faz, thank you, Mark. Faz Shakir over at thinkprogress.org, what do you see on the horizon? What are the stories that in your mind are bubbling that we are paying way too little attention to,
or maybe
we don't even know about yet?
Well, I think that the one that we're all waiting for and we're all kind of gearing up for is Alberto Gonzalez's replacement. You know, and there's been a lot of rumors as to who that might be. Newsmax has an article today suggesting that there are 5 candidates that are kind of leading the pack A lot of them are names that we've heard or, you know, have been floated before. Paul Clement, who's now the acting attorney general, I guess, or who will be the acting attorney general, he's one. George Terwilliger, who is the former deputy attorney general under President George H.W. Bush. Then you have Senator Orrin Hatch was one, actually. That would be interesting. So I think that everybody's kind of gearing up for this fight, and they all want to get involved in this, and they want to start doing the research on whoever the nominee will be. But everyone's kind of in this waiting pattern, trying to figure out who will be the nominee so that they can start digging into that person's record. Because I think that from what I see on the groups on the left, it's more not about the candidate as much as it's about making sure that the candidate is independent from the White House.
And also potentially using the process as one to raise some of these issues that had to do with Mr. Gonzalez and his past. And in fact, the fact that there hasn't been an appointment, there hasn't been a recess appointment, is, in my mind anyway, solidifying the possibility that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi cut a deal, or maybe just Harry Reid, cut a deal with the Bush White House, that if Congress could go on vacation, that the Bush White House would not do any recess appointments during that vacation, and that part of that deal was that also we'll pass this FISA bill for you if you'll let us get out of here, and that deal, you know, the FISA deal part of that has come back to haunt the Democrats big time. The no recess appointments may come back to haunt the Republicans.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah.
And
I think you put your finger on one of the other major fights, of course, is the FISA bill, because that I think that there's been a lot of activity from progressive groups around that, and we're all waiting until Congress gets back into session to get the fire under them to try to rein this back in. But, of course, it's a lot harder, you know, even though this is a sunset provision and it'll expire in 5 months, this recent FISA bill, it's hard to get Congress to pull back, because as soon as it's in the law, then you have a different debate. Right now it's about extending these needed powers versus approving very expansive powers.
Right.
They've already approved it. Now they just want
to keep Plus, the president has the power to say, okay, we're going to snoop on Faz Shakir for the next 12 months. He can initiate a wiretap for up to 12 months. And so if he does that on the day before the law expires, he's going to have a wiretap on you right up until pretty much the day he leaves office.
Yeah, he's got basically everything he wanted, and I think it's important to note that the program is much wider than individuals. The program that was approved was a wide dragnet on information, and so
yeah.
what the administration needs to be doing is casting a very wide net for a lot of information without any
sure.
kind of.
And program. I think frankly they're also spying on Democrats. I just can't believe they're not doing it. Mark Carlin, we only have a minute left. What are you seeing on the horizon here, Mark?
I think the FISA spying thing is very important. I think that Pelosi and Reid are going to be in a very difficult position because, as your listeners know, Tom, or most of them should, the ACLU is running ads with depicting Pelosi and Reid as sheep on the FISA bill. The second thing, of course, is this is the second anniversary, as I'm sure you've mentioned, of the Katrina. And I think the thing that ties Katrina with Iraq is the corruption in terms of the vendors and no contract bidding that the Bush administration secured in both cases, and that both of them were dismal failures as far as the federal government's intervention is concerned. And that corruption will continue to be the hallmark of the Bush administration.
Yeah, what we're seeing is that if you don't believe in government, you can't govern. And thus, Republicans don't run governments well. Faz Shakir, thinkprogress.org. Mark Carlin, buzzflash.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program right here on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Just another poor boy off the plan of rich man's war. Buy me an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue is a moment of land and kind of heart.
stack overdue bills, and when I'll save the world. It's been a year now, he's still in, chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and took his car. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Just a quick reminder, tomorrow we'll be doing our show live on C-SPAN from noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, the time we've been doing this show for the last 5 years. In fact, this is our second time on C-SPAN. It was back, we got to track down that date. I think it was about 3, maybe 4 years ago that we did our show live on C-SPAN. From back at that time, I was living in Vermont, so it's got to be at least 3 years ago and maybe 4 years ago. And it was a great time. We had a great time, and I'm really looking forward to doing it again tomorrow. So if you want to see the studio and see David, and maybe he'll even show his tattoos, I don't know. We'll see. Check it out. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Pat in San Diego, California. Hey, Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's so great talking to you. I attended the preview yesterday for the 11th hour here in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a wonderful documentary, and I was so gratified to see you up there being interviewed along with a lot of great scientists. I wanted to make the comment that I loved the focus that they gave it. It wasn't just global warming. It was a greater notice about why we're suffering through this and what the corporate government has to do with it. And I thought that was just a wonderful message from the film.
Yeah, I agree. The 11th Hour, Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, there's a trailer for it up at the top of TomHartman.com. And obviously the site for the film is 11thHourFilm.com. It's also an action site where you can let friends and others know about it, 11thHourAction.com. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah, I am urging people to go to that site and find out when the film shows in their areas and to go see it. The one thing I wish they would have done more is to post the websites for the environmental organizations, because when people come out of these movies feeling that they would like to be actively helping, it would have been good if they could have posted those or maybe had handouts.
Well, that's a good idea. I'll pass it along to the folks at the studio who I know who are doing it. And you know, this is a shoestring operation. Not entirely. You know, this is a relatively small operation, and you've got a lot of people who are really committed and really overworked trying to make it happen. We did, and Pat, thank you for the call. We did last night here in Portland. Also, we did a sneak peek preview. The movie, I believe, is opening this weekend in Portland. And the theater was totally, totally slammed. In fact, they were turning away people at the door, unfortunately. And we had a great time. It was marvelous to see the movie. This is, I think, the fourth time I've seen the movie. And every time I learn something new, it is really, truly remarkable. 11thHourFilm.com. Colin in Venice, California. Hey, Colin, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a quick point about this $50 billion supplemental that's coming up. So I think it's kind of disingenuous to use that number, because Bush has already put in $147 billion in the defense budget. So he's actually asking for another $197 billion.
Right, but the defense budget was passed as a separate budget, wasn't it? I mean, this what you're saying is that the total cost of the war for this year is going to be $147 billion.
197, yeah.
Or 197, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that'll raise more eyebrows, and people start saying that number for this year rather than a supplemental, more people will be like, all right, what the hell's going on now?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And we're right up on, coming up on almost $1 billion a day. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-boggling for Iraq. And, you know, $1 billion a day, what we could do with that in the United States. Roberta in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Roberta.
Hi, how you doing? I was also at the KLSD screening of 11th Hour last night, and wow, you know, it really spoke to my heart. Was that a Hopi elder? Do you know?
The Native American
gentleman?
The Native American guy was with the Haudenosaunee, the what we call the Iroquois.
Okay.
The five nations up in the Northeast.
Well, the person that I took to the screening with me had some comments afterward and said, this needs to be shared with the young people. This needs to be shared in the schools, in the grade schools, the junior highs, and the high schools.
Yep. There was one of the very early screenings of the 11th Hour down in L.A. was done where a woman, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her name, but she's a relatively famous model, you know, and has some cash. And she bought 600 or 700 tickets for inner city kids from L.A. to go see a screening of the movie. And it just, you know, they just went nuts. They just loved it. And it's a marvelous thing. So I can't say enough about it. It's a movie that you've got to see. Rick in San Luis Obispo. We've got about 20 seconds here, Rick, before we got to wrap the show up. You want to make a quick comment?
Yeah, I realize that the single-payer concept is somewhat flawed because the government, with all of its fluctuations, would be in control of it. I've witnessed the problems in the Veterans Administration. And the answer...
But on the other hand, Social Security has never failed to write a check. I mean, the biggest problem the Veterans Administration has right now is that they don't have a large enough constituency to be as powerful a force as they could. If everybody in America was getting their health care through a single payer, through Medicare, Medicare would get cleaned up really fast. Tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls. We'll be live on C-SPAN, as I mentioned. Check your local listings. Conservative Yaron Brook and I will be debating income inequality. Conservative Cord Bloomquist, should Wi-Fi be free coast to coast? And the best of the rest of the news in your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.